Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, to Your Cases on Hold, the JBJS podcast brought to you by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld, not in the same states, but that doesn't matter. We're at episode 69. This is November 5th, if you're listening to the day we drop for the November 6th issue. As always, we are covering the best and brightest, the absolute highlights of orthopedic research published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. Our opinions and the takes are our own and not those of the editor-in-chief, the constituent journals, the supporting editors, the other members of the editorial board, or the board of trustees at JBJS. This episode is brought to you by JBJS CME. You heard it before, you're going to hear it again. I absolutely, honestly believe I'm not trying to sell you on something. This is the truth. I'm not just somebody who's reading an advertising byline. I'm a subscriber. I believe in it. JBJS CME is the absolute best one-stop shopping where you can not only have access to the cutting edge of orthopedic research, the things that are going to show up on the OITE in the future, on the part one and part two of the boards, or things you might want to use to support your part two of the boards, on the maintenance of certification, web-based longitudinal assessments. You can get all of that wraparound 360 services at the jbjs.org CME. So you absolutely should check it out. If you're not already using it, you're missing out. Get credit for stuff you're already doing. Get credit for things that are going to help you in your career, in your research, in your board certification. And if you haven't already, check that out. And while you're at it, check out our back issues. Give us a 5-star rating. Hit the notification bell. Make sure that you're getting access to every one of these episodes that we're putting out. It is twice a month for those who don't know. And for those who also don't know, I am Andrew Schoenfeld, Deputy Editor for Methods at the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. And as always, my partner in dissecting orthopedic research,
Antonia Chen, Deputy Editor of Adult Reconstruction. And I like the word dissecting because we are going to be slicing and dicing this time around.
Yes, yes. This is definitely a dissection heavy episode. And we'll get right into it. Top of the pile, our impact on global warming, a carbon footprint analysis of orthopedic operations by Eidman and colleagues. Visual summary, 30 days free. There have been a lot of articles on this. This is a little bit more comprehensive and forward-looking, so something definitely worth checking out. 35 years of reporting of sex and race in clinical studies of U.S. FDA-approved orthopedic devices by Jiang. Then we have patients' preferences for bone-anchored prostheses after lower extremity amputation, a two-center discrete choice experiment in the Netherlands by Salaib, and this is permanently free. We then have delayed unions or non-unions of the distal femur, a comprehensive overview by Rodriguez Barron, My Death Education by Noland, also permanently free, What's Important, Health Literacy and Orthopedics by Lum and colleagues, permanently free, Individualized Surgeon Reports in a Statewide Registry, A Pathway to Improved Outcomes by Mesko and colleagues. Then we have a kind of a longer-term follow-up of a previously published randomized controlled trial, reverse shoulder arthroplasty is superior to plate fixation for displaced proximal humerus fractures in the elderly. 5-year follow-up of the DEL-FI randomized controlled trial by Fraser and colleagues with an infographic, also 30 days free. And then lastly, there's an obituary for Paul Francis Lakiewicz, MD, 1951 to 2024. Before we get into the headlines, I've just instituted a new segment called Grinding My Gears. Just allow me a second here while I set up my soapbox. And I believe, you know, I recognize that we have a bully pulpit here, but I fully intend to use it. And what's grinding my gears in the nexus, the research nexus at this time are, now, the first thing I want to say is that this is a composite. So I don't want any listener to say, oh, I wrote a letter and he's talking about me, because I'm not talking about anyone in particular. I'm talking about a number of salient develops that have occurred to me or that I've observed at conferences or at, you know, various venues where this has been brought up in the last couple of weeks. But I'm seeing it enough to feel like it's a palpable undercurrent in orthopedics these days. I think it's one thing that we should be getting away from, but it still seems to persist inexplicably. So I want to speak to it. It is the open pessimism with which methodologic rigor is met in our community. Do you know what I'm talking about, Antonia?
In terms of the question whether or not the methods should be rigorously scrutinized, or you tell someone that this is how it should have been done and they dismiss it?
No, more the former, where there's just this sort of like, it either comes up where it's presented as, oh, here we go, the methods people just, here, you know, they just have to take over every single project, or they just have to critique everything. What we are publishing here is supposed to be science. And science means that it is the methods that are driving your material work. You can't have the conclusions without the methods. So the first thing is that you start talking about methodologic things or methodologic expectations, and you start getting these eye rolls. Like you say, the work isn't hypothesis driven. And then the answer is, well, I mean, like, they could figure out what the hypothesis was. Like, we don't need to tell them that. We obviously, you know what the no, we obviously don't know what the hypothesis is,
because you don't remind.
It's your responsibility to tell the audience what the hypothesis is. And that's not the same. Having a hypothesis is not the same thing as hypothesis driven. And then another one, and this grinds my gears even more, is where you get like this pushback where they're like, look, we just wanted to show how our procedure or our experience is just like the best. That's all we wanted to do. We just wanted to show that what we were doing is amazing and everyone else should do it. And then here come the methods people, you know, asking us to do all sorts of statistical analyses. Our intention wasn't to do statistical analyses. It was just to show how awesome we are. It is tongue in cheek. You know, I'm being a little bit facetious about it, but that's essentially what they're saying. They'll just reiterate what it was they wanted to show and say, we just wanted to show this. And it's like, well, you can only show it if it's translatable, generalizable. And if you're submitting the work to high impact journals, premier tier journals, top tier journals, first tier journals, and by that, I mean like the brand name publications or the leading publication in your specialty or subspecialty, and you're not providing like methodologically robust work, your expectation should not be, oh, this will get accepted. The expectation should be, this is probably going to get rejected. We'll take a shot and we'll take our best angle at it. Or maybe we'll get good feedback and we'll get some good input, but it shouldn't be like, this is a shoo-in to get in. And then you shouldn't be surprised when it comes back and they say like, you can't just do, you know, your last 30 cases of this procedure or your approach without, you know, their selection bias, indication bias, restricted clinical variation, all of these things. You start mentioning them and you get this, oh, here they are, you know, trying to scare us with their devotion to the weirdness. It's like every other discipline, this is baseline. General surgery, medicine, rheumatology, like, this is just, those are the base expectations in urology. I mean, I can go on and on. And I don't want to like, you know, make the audience's ears bleed. But I think this is something that we have a blind spot in for whatever reason in orthopedics. I don't really understand it.
I'm going to put my two cents in here. And I completely agree with you. I think the hardest part about orthopedics is that historically, our literature was based on case reports. And, you know, you look at JBJS 1986 or, you know, something like that, right? And you go to the original literature there, it started with, this is what I did. And then people just grew from there, right? So here's my series of 10, here's my series of 50, here's my series of 100. And that's something hard to shed, if that makes sense. right? Like if you look at medicine and you look at the old literature, I don't think they started like, they started with some rigorous stuff just to be off the bat, right? And they, you know, obviously went to RCTs faster than we did. They moved away from p-values faster than we did. You know, they moved, I think, from the realm of, hey, this is what I did and anecdotal sharing to this is rigorous science. And I think making that leap is hard because a lot of what we do is like, you know, why do I do this part of the case? Well, has there been an RCT on this part of the case? No, and there's not. So, but, you know, I still do a medial peel in my, you know, tibia because I need to get exposure, right? So not every part has been studied. And I think the unfortunate that contributes to what we consider scientific evaluation.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, you have like the right outlook for the historical context about why we face this, but it's up to us to combat it. And I'll leave it at that.
So and this is our way of combating it.
Yeah. Yeah. One JBJS, your case on hold podcast at a time. You're coming with the level 4 case series. It's going on hold. So this is not this was not a preamble to my headline, which obviously I selected as a headline. So I thought there's definitely some things interesting about it. This is a prognostic study, outcomes of total knee arthroplasty following a sham incision procedure in patients with previous knee incisions. This is by Zink and colleagues. This was conducted at New England Baptist, our neighbors across the road in Boston. And, you know, this is an interesting study that brings into play individuals who have had previous surgery with impaired wound healing environments. And they wanted to look at using a sham incision as a means to allow detection of wound healing problems prior to performing the total knee. This is something that they're doing. Patients who had prior knee incisions, undergone a sham incision prior to total knee, minimum follow-up of 2 years were identified. Cases were retrospectively reviewed. They identify this as a prognostic study, but it is graded level 4. From what I read, it didn't seem like there was a selection bias. They were just doing this. They have 47 cases of 47 knees. They basically waited almost half a year following the sham incision to do, it was 21.1 weeks, range 4 to 163. No cases of skin necrosis or periprosthetic joint infection at an average follow-up of almost 5 years after the sham incision. A total of 11 patients required manipulation under anesthesia, but I don't think that's related to this at all. So, you know, they kind of do this as an interesting way to sort of test the environment and see if they would be a problem and then adjust accordingly. It is a retrospective series. It is prone to expertise bias. It's a limited sample such that I don't think you can necessarily extrapolate the results. As we've discussed, when everything is always or everything is never, you can't really assume that it's going to translate perfectly into any other clinical environment. So the study may have been underpowered to detect rare adverse events or, you know, other problems in terms of the ability of this sham incision to effectively prognosticate the healing potential in these patients. But I think it is a challenging problem. And I think it is a unique and different approach to try and determine how this would work. You know, I will say just as an aside, you know, something, a best practice, they have their figure one, which is a clinical image of a 58-year-old male with a history of previous knee incisions who underwent the sham incision, allowing detection of a disc vascular area of skin over the tibial tubercle. So the proximal part of the incision was then used for the total knee, but they sort of made kind of an ellipse, sort of like a tangent to avoid the disc vascular area. But they show like a pre-surgical picture and then two post-surgical pictures, one immediately post-TKA and one in follow-up, they say, but it looks like the sutures are still in. In any case, just, you know, when giving consideration to figures, to including figures in papers, I think that figures are best done when they illustrate something that people can't wrap their head around, or they're showing something that you would otherwise expend a great deal of time writing. You know, you're saving word count by showing something as a figure, or they make the paper memorable. In this case, the figure doesn't really do any of those things because If you just said, like, we found this vascular area and we changed the incision, and this is obviously just one out of 47 incisions. So they modified the incisions however they saw fit. It's not necessarily speaking to the actual performance of the sham incision procedure. That's not really a critique of the article per se. There's nothing to put on hold here. The only caveat is that I thought it was a teachable moment as far as some, you know, general guidance about consideration for figures and papers. And then if you're looking to apply this in your own practice, you may not necessarily experience the same results that they did.
On hold or not on hold?
No, there's nothing to put on hold, like I said.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, cool. All right. After what we talk about, I'm going to do the same thing. I am not putting this one on hold either.
So this is liposomal bupivacaine does not decrease postoperative pain in patients with intracapsular femoral neck fracture treated with hemiarthroplasty. I guess that's the name of their trial, a randomized controlled trial by Kang and colleagues. And there is an infographic. Take it away.
So historically, there have been no differences in elective procedures, typically when comparing liposomal bupivacaine to bupivacaine. But there really haven't been a lot of studies in the trauma literature. And in theory, it's a great population to use liposomal bupivacaine in, especially as geriatric patients, because if it can reduce the amount of MMEs or the amount of opioids that you take, that could have impact on outcomes such as dementia, fall risk, things like that. And interestingly enough, the authors pointed out there was a 2017 proposal by the OTA, which is the Orthopedic Trauma Association, entitled "Hip Fracture Patients Treated with Exparel versus Standard of Care Will Have Better Outcomes." And Exparel is this liposomal bupivacaine. And the authors directly wanted to address this in their study, which is a good idea. So what this study did is compared liposomal bupivacaine combined with bupivacaine, so 40 cc of liposomal bupivacaine combined with 20 cc of bupivacaine versus bupivacaine HCL, which is Marcaine, and a full 60 cc, so the same volume between both groups, in geriatric hip fracture patients who sustained an intracapsular hip fracture, and they were treated specifically with hip hemiarthroplasty. No total hip arthroplasties, but hip hemiarthroplasties. And geriatric patients were defined as patients greater than 65 years old. And it was a single center randomized prospective double-blinded study of 50 patients. And this is from March 2018 to April 22 in a single institution. And the double-blind was the research fellow working with the nursing staff was drawing up the appropriate injection material so that the surgical staff had no idea what they were injecting. And then on the floor, when they were looking at the VAS pain score and the MME or the VSA pain score, it was done by the orthopedic residents who are blinded to the treatment as well. 50 people was not a huge number of people for a study. And so they did do a lot of sample size justification. They looked at one of them based on VAS. So one study said that you need 20 patients to detect a 1 to 2 point difference in the VAS pain score and a pill count difference of one pill per day. They also did another calculation based on the number of milligrams of opioids needed per day. And you need even less patients. You needed 8 patients. But they said if they were looking at the, you know, certain amount of power level, sampling ratio, standard deviation, and effect size, and given a 10% attrition rate, they needed 40 people in the study. So they went to 50 to be safe. Of note, they said because they included 50 patients, the study was powered to detect differences as low as 0.42 milligrams per day. Doesn't put it in the context of MME, but it was milligrams per day. One patient from the control group was excluded due to postoperative death. I think the take-home message here is the injection technique. And the manufacturer will say that. You have to inject it in a certain way. I think all of us are as meticulous in our injection methods, but just for the sake of our listeners here, and if you do hip anything, they use multiple 20 milliliter syringes with 22 gauge spinal needles. Now, the manufacturer will say 25 gauge needles, but they use 22 gauge needles in the study. They start medially and posteriorly. The capsule is injected circumferentially in 10 to 12 locations with 2 to 3 milliliters in each location while watching for the capsule to slightly swell. The posterior capsule was injected around the neck of the implant, and care was taken to ensure that the needle only penetrated the capsule to a depth of 1 to 2 centimeters to prevent sciatic or femoral nerve injury, and the remaining bupivacaine was then used to inject the abductors and tensor fasciae latae. That's a lot of locations. And then they looked at total MME at 12, 24, and 48 hours postoperatively, VAS score for 4, 8, 12, 24, and 48 hours, and then time to ambulation with physical therapy as their primary outcomes, and a bunch of different secondary outcomes, including length of stay, discharge disposition, 30-day readmission, delirium, and any adverse effects, events, or complications. This is a randomized study. There were no differences in demographics, is what you expect. And not surprisingly, I would say, because this has been borne out in other parts of literature, liposomal bupivacaine versus bupivacaine alone showed similar VAS score, similar total MME score, similar mean postoperative day of ambulation, 1.4 days in the liposomal bupivacaine versus 1.1 days in the liposomal bupivacaine group versus 1.4 days in the control group. Mean post-op day of discharge was 4 days in the liposomal bupivacaine group versus 3.9 days in the control group. One patient in the liposomal bupivacaine group developed delirium at 24 hours, which resolved at 48 hours, and there were no delirium patients in the control group. So the take-home message is that both groups were very similar with regards to pain control, and it didn't really do what the hypothesis said it would, which is make patients less painful and less opioids needed if they were to use liposomal bupivacaine, which tells me that I think the take-home message is the technique. You do a good technique, you put all these medications all around to give some local pain control, it can help your patients. What I'd be really nice to see is a cost analysis. The authors do acknowledge that they don't have patient-reported outcomes, and I would like to see that as well too, because maybe there are subtle differences that this is beneficial. And the authors do acknowledge that the sample size is adequate but small. So will different things be borne out with bigger patient populations? Not according to their sample size calculation. And I leave my stats editor to tell me more about that. But I think this is an interesting study and a good patient population, and shows us that liposomal bupivacaine is not the holy grail.
Yeah, I mean, nothing to put on hold here as far as the RCT goes. Well done methodologically. I tell patients there are three reasons injections don't work. Obviously, these are not the injections that I'm dealing with. Those are spinal injections. But one is it's the wrong indication, which wouldn't play into this. Two is technique, operator error. And three is, you know, the genetic milieu or the patient's individual responsiveness, metabolism, resistance, what have you, pain perceptions. So I think in this case, technique is going to be the main driver, like you said. Let's get into the your cases on hold featurette. No discernible difference in revision rate or survivorship between posterior cruciate retaining and posterior cruciate substituting total knee arthroplasty. By Kim and colleagues, this does come with a commentary, so you don't have to take it from us. This is a longer-term follow-up of a randomized study that has an astounding, I think, follow-up, like 19.5 years.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Pretty impressive. Yeah. It's pretty impressive.
And, you know, essentially they had 300 patients who underwent simultaneous bilateral total knees, something that I think the literature does not really support doing in the current climb. So this is probably something that you couldn't really repeat. I remember doing those. I hated doing those as a resident, being in on cases where it was like two separate teams working on the, you know, one team on the left knee, one team on the right knee.
Those are my favorite cases, Andrew.
Oh my gosh. Felt like you were in the middle of like combat. There was just tissue and blood flying like everywhere. And, oh, yeah. No, I hated those cases. But anyway, not really good for patients, I don't think. We don't do
bilateral. Good operative time overall.
Yes, good in operative time. Yes, that's about where it stops. Physiologic hit off the charts. But anyway, so this was an opportunity for a natural experiment where they went with a cruciate retaining and PS and CR, you know, one in each knee essentially. And it was a consecutive series of 300 patients. Each patient received a next-gen CR flex prosthesis on one side and then an LPS flex prosthesis on the contralateral side. Mean follow-up was 18 years. The range was 17.5 to 19.5. So I misspoke to some degree. But anyway, it's still astounding as far as I'm concerned, 18-year follow-up. There were no significant differences between the next-gen CR and the LPS flex at latest follow-up with regard to the Knee Society knee scores. 93 versus 92. WOMAC, 19.1 for both. UCLA activity score, 6.1 for both. Range of motion, basically just like 1 degree difference and well within the standard deviation. Radiographic and CT results, and revision rate, 6 versus 6.3%. No evidence of osteolysis. Estimated survival rate was 94% for the next gen CR and essentially 94% for the LPS flex with revision or aseptic loosening as the endpoint. I thought this was a fascinating study. The authors maintain it presents long-term clinical results endorsing CR flex or LPS flex implants produce excellent clinical and radiographic results. That seems like a little advertising spiel, but no notable clinical advantage one way or the other. They appropriately graded as therapeutic level 2. It's not a level 1 study because presumably they weren't powered to like continue this out for 18 years. And invariably there's going to, but they had really good follow-up anyway. And at the end of the day, all those points in terms of the outcomes are right where you would want them to be, to essentially say there is no discernible difference. Like everything is almost the same. And that probably has to do with the fact that, you know, these are two knees, but they're in the same person, right?
Right. And that's the variable that becomes a question, right? That will this person do well no matter what? There's anatomy considerations, there's demographic considerations. And I think we're realizing more and more as total joint surgeons, like that plays a bigger factor, expectation, all sorts of things like that, than all sorts of variables that we, you know, put 1 degree more slope in or, you know, do a little thing here and a little thing there. We think that makes a bigger impact probably.
Yeah, that the anticipated, the factors that are driving the outcomes are probably bigger picture things that have to do with the patient who's getting them than these, you know, subtle differences in terms of like, you know, this is a custom implant versus this is cruciate retaining versus this is substituting or what have you.
I'll agree. And there's different methods as to why you would use one versus the other. But as long as, like, for example, I would use a posterior stabilized if there was medial lateral instability. But, you know, if you're putting the wrong implant in the wrong person, they're not going to do well. But you're assuming that you could do either one here, then the metrics that they're using, while good and what they have available, because this is very long follow-up, doesn't really underscore the things like if you're going to cut the box out, that's going to be bone loss. Like, is that a problem? You know, that those sorts of things that you don't really get from the subtleties of evaluating these things. You're basically saying, has it been revised? No. Has it done well? Yes. And if it's the right type of demographic patient to your point, or, you know, it's appropriate that you have either one of them, then they'll do fine.
All right. So definitely really just a lot of kudos to Dr. Kim and their team. Nothing to go on hold here this week. The case is green. Ready to go. And maybe your case is ready to go. We're kind of running out of time here, so we're going to work through the honorable mentions. Outcomes of obese patients undergoing primary total knee arthroplasty, trends over 30 years by Uvodich and colleagues. This study relied on an institutional total joint registry with 13,900 plus primary total knees performed between 1990 and 2019. There was a 90% increase in the prevalence of class 2 obesity and a 300% increase in class 3 obesity over the observed years. They said, despite increasing rates of obesity among our patients, we observed decreasing risks of reoperation revision and PJI over time. The risk of reoperation revision declined among non-obese, stable for class 1 and 2, and declined for class 3. PJI risk declined for non-obese patients over the study period, but no such decline occurred for any category of obesity. Despite decreasing risks, they say further work is needed to improve infection or the risk of infection in obese patients. We don't usually comment on these, but I just feel like it's a necessary sort of a, you know, disclaimer. This is the exact, you know, this study is demonstrating when we talk about secular trends, exactly what secular trends are. Like, we're getting so much better at doing these procedures because of technology, because of perioperative medical management, preoperative optimization. All of this is showing that we can perform surgery on patients who previously would have had worse outcomes or maybe not even have been considered candidates for surgery. But there's also the potential, you know, this is an institutional registry. So there's also the potential for expertise bias and a selection bias, even amongst or within the various classes. You know, perhaps they're really good at determining it's not necessarily applicable to all class three obese patients. And that's just going to be based on a BMI. You know, that could be someone who is of a bigger stature, maybe, you know, like an endomorphic stature, but still also really muscular. That's going to be different from somebody who, where all of that is, you know, in the realm of adiposity. So an interesting study, a nice longitudinal study, but still buyer beware, as far as I'm concerned. Next, we have long-term outcomes of arthroscopically verified focal cartilage lesions in the knee, a 19-year multi-center follow-up with patient-reported outcomes. This is the long-term follow-up issue of your cases on hold, or JBJS, however you want to look at it. This is by Burkinas and colleagues with a comment and is permanently free. They had 553 eligible patients treated between 1999 and 2012 in six major Norwegian hospitals. They were evaluating 322 patients and 328 knees. Again, the ability to do this is going to be limited to certain centers, and it's just really astounding that they were able to pull off as much as they did. But it is incredibly invaluable information. At mean follow-up of 19 years, patients with an FCL who did not require subsequent knee arthroplasty had significantly higher PROM scores. Non-surgical treatment had results equal to those of surgical treatment, except for ACI, which was associated with a better CUS and lower risk of treatment failure. Full thickness lesions, lower level education, greater BMI were main risk factors associated with poor results. So this is just great information, I think, that can help surgeons and patients understand the outlook from these kinds of procedures. And then lastly, we have relationship of fracture morphological characteristics with posterolateral corner injuries in hyperextension varus tibial plateau fractures by Wang and colleagues, permanently free. They had a total of 50 patients in the study, 28 in what they call group one without fracture of the posterior column and group two with fracture of the posterior column. They found that the posterolateral corner injury is relatively high in these types of fractures. Without fracture of the posterior column, a small fracture area strongly suggests an accompanying PLC injury, and PLC injury is frequently combined with posterior cruciate ligament injury. That brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks for sticking with us. If you like what you heard, like and subscribe. Check us out next time. If you didn't, thanks for listening as long as you did, and we hope that you come back next time. We went a little bit long today. I appreciate you bearing with our public service announcements and our general edification points. Check us out next time when Dr. Chen will be heading things up. Hopefully your case is ready to go, as all the projects were here in this episode. But in reality, everything here is still on hold.
And I just want to clarify, I'd like to thank you for being a deputy editor of Methods and for all your methodological contributions to the scientific literature in orthopedics.
It is my distinct pleasure.